and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb Keith, and today I am joined by Bruce Hillman, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. This is our regular cast of hosts on the Thinking Fellows. We've had some guests on recently. We had Magnus Persson on, and Bruce and I have done some interviews in the past too, so you can check those out if you're curious. But yeah, this is our regular cast. I think, is this the first time we've recorded in 2024? Probably not. I lose track of this. I think we recorded last
year. The one with Magnus was in 2024.
But, you know, welcome to New Thinking Fellows listeners. If you're listening in the new year, the Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. So we're part of a bigger family of shows. If you enjoyed this episode of the Thinking Fellows podcast, or you've enjoyed previous episodes, you should go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our material there. We have 21 shows. We have everything from biblical exegesis to shows on history and systematic theology and philosophy and basically everything you might be interested in. And so if you enjoy this, there's other shows like this that you could enjoy this week. Today we are going to pick up sort of, I think, an extension of a couple other topics we have done on the show about sort of the decline of Christianity or the retreat of Christianity in the West and the United States. And we did this a little bit with Magnus in Europe and stuff today. And I want to pick up sort of an extension of that that Pew and various other polling data that we talked about, which showed sort of between 2010 and 2021, I forget the end date of what we actually looked at, there was a 14% decline in people who call themselves or associate with Christianity, and I think it was like a 13.5% increase in those who say willingness to say no religious affiliation at all. So sort of almost a one-to-one loss to gain ratio. I found an adjacent sort of set of data where they, you know, sort of did like exit poll style questions as to asking why. And the most common answer given was that my personal values no longer align with the values of the religion that I'm leaving. And I think anecdotally, this sort of lines up, and probably it is, you know, what people mean when, like Bruce, you were bringing up that the homosexuality issues in the United States or sexuality issues in the United States are one of the most common ones you hear, right, and run into. We've talked about on the show before sort of the accusation that my parents or those who stayed in the religion are hypocrites or whatever. And so there is this idea that, yeah, people are, their personal values, morals, ethics, whatever you want to call them, change, and the ones in the religion haven't kept up with them. And so I'm leaving. I guess the question is how are Christians supposed to deal with this? My sort of gut reaction is that what this tells me is there is a failure to build values into the next generation, and maybe not even build, but pass down those values in a meaningful way, where some sort of external value to your family or to the religious practitioners is actually being adopted, you know, in some ways quicker than the passing down of the values. And so, yeah, what is there a solution to this? Are there some suggestions? Are there any other sort of important thoughts to deal with when we talk about how do you pass down Christian values if the declaration of new values is the number one reason people say they're leaving Christianity?
So this is interesting to do this today because Adam and I spent the weekend at various, I'd say apologetics lectures, but they were mostly intelligent design lectures, right? The field of science, I guess, or apologetics that is intelligent design. And so we had a lot of opportunity to talk about, you know, why would anybody even work so hard on intelligent design? And is this important? And how is important? Where does it fit in? Where does it fit in within sort of the proclamation of the gospel and the defense of the faith and all that kind of stuff? But it was interesting to me. One of the observations that I had kind of all weekend is that I think that That was with the Discovery Institute. And I think that the work that they do is certainly important. But I'd say in my experience with conversations with people who were once Christian and now aren't, or people who were never Christian and are sort of refuse to entertain the idea of being Christian, it more has to do with values. And often specifically, values around sexuality. So many people leave the faith because Christianity, as they were growing up, was a moral proposition and maybe one that was only talked about on Sunday at church, and the rest of their life was filled with all sorts of other moral propositions that, you know, thou shalt not commit adultery is just something that you hear, and all everything that goes along with that. Is just something that you hear in church and not something that the rest of the world even really thinks about. And that there's a lot of quote unquote freedom when it comes to how to live one's life sexually, both before getting married, during marriage, and after marriage. And that it doesn't align. And when you talk to people, I think for the most part, when you talk to people who aren't Christians, this is the same thing. It does, you know, the values doesn't usually mean that they're objecting to murder being wrong, maybe with the exception of the case of abortion. It's not like they, on the whole, object to theft as wrong.
Except maybe redistribution of wealth.
Yeah, except maybe this kind of under political means.
Yeah.
But not direct theft. I actually had this conversation once with a young man in class who was trying to argue with me that theft was not a universal sort of
that it's a cultural,
not everybody, you know, some people thought it was just fine and it should be just fine. And he had his laptop sitting on his desk in front of him, and I just kind of went and casually picked it up and took it up to the lectern and kept lecturing, and until he objected that I took his laptop. And I said, well, I thought theft was fine. I really liked your laptop. It's better than mine. So, you know, this isn't the objection. Usually it's usually very cultural stuff. If that makes any sense. So specifically cultural stuff. So that doesn't help the discussion on moving it forward. I just think it's interesting that Adam and I spent a good part of the weekend talking about apologetics and, you know, where is the interplay with that? And the fact that most objections to the faith are no longer expressly intellectual. They're a lot of them, if not all, you know, most of them emotionally driven because they think somebody's telling them what to do.
Yeah, I think you could say emotionally, but morally driven at the same time, right? And we might say that that moral shift is primarily emotional, not intellectual. Like it's pretty easy to refute most of it from an intellectual perspective, but not from the feelings perspective. Adam, you have thoughts, I can see.
I do, but I can't articulate them yet. I think your dad and you are right. The stuff you're seeing on my face is just frustration. Like, we live in a very different epistemological age.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it.
One of the speakers, David Berlinski, I've heard him in heard this weekend, was in a different lecture. I think it was on YouTube or a podcast maybe that I heard it. He was talking about the shift away from I think he described it as a naive empiricism that says to be is to be perceived, right? Yeah. So like what is true is what you can empirically verify, like at that moment. That's like extreme empiricism. Now today he says it's more to be, or what is true is what is believed.
Right.
So like whatever it is people believe or want to do is regardless of whether it conflicts with nature or tradition or whatever, that's the new truth. And it's just like this endless morass.
The philosophers actually blame this on the internet, that, you know, a simulated world. So like they've done actual sociological studies.
Is this your Baudrillard?
Yeah. Baudrillard would do that too. It would had predicted this as well, yes. But they did some sociological studies years ago. I mean, I had this in college in sociology. And what they did is they asked young kids who were around like 13 to 16, somewhere around there. And it was a pretty large sample. It was something like 600, 700 kids. They were U.S. and Canadian kids. And they asked them if they saw virtual space, how they related to virtual space versus actual space, meaning like being physically present with someone versus communicating with them online in some way. And they found that basically anyone over 20 found a virtual space to be a far less intimate and real space. But the kids who had grown up on it and were now very mature and had skill sets on the virtual space, who were 16 or whatever, they didn't see any intimacy differences or perceive anything different about avatars and about Zoom calls. They didn't have Zoom then, but, you know, whatever it was, Skype and stuff. Skype, yeah. And they've consistently done these studies, and they find that people nowadays, the younger you are, or the younger generation you are, the less likely you are to distinguish that a virtual space is fundamentally any different than a physical, true space. And if that is true, or at least if that's plausible, that that might be true, then it would make sense that like what people imagine about the world would have a much greater effect on the way they think the world should be than it is now. And you don't really see this sort of idea until the internet age. You can't really find it in the old philosophy or in science. You don't really have this idea of like a simulacrum or something that's fake that becomes real.
True. I mean, you always had solipsists, right? But they're always like marginal figures.
Right.
I think thinking full circle now, like that's kind of what's like, Caleb, this is probably a pretty big issue for you. It is for me, and I think that, and I know it is for Bruce and Scott as well, but you have young kids. I've got youngish kids still, and as they're growing up, interacting with other kids their age who come from households who might have radically different values, I'm without the emotion, I don't mean it this emotionally,
but scary.
It's scary.
Yeah.
thinking what my kids might get wrapped up in.
I mean, I kind of, you know, I had this interesting, you know, my wife and I had an interesting decision to make because my kids had a neighborhood friend who is a very decent friend. Parents are decent from like all the, you know, the typical standards, decent people, right? They don't steal. They're not murderers. They use kind words with their kid and stuff like that. But the more they hung out, and you go to the park and stuff and you talk to their parents, the more I realized the only ethical position these people had was love and be nice. And I could just see on the wall why that was fine and why that meant their daughter wasn't mean right now and stuff like that. But now in like 5 years, you know, that love and be nice is the introduction of homosexuality as a universal good to my children through another child. And so we sort of backed that relationship off, even though there's no wrong done, because I could see that the value alignment system wasn't there between the two families, because the one principle they had was be nice to people no matter what. And I think that is probably the ruling sort of dominant idea in my generation, and that's the dominant idea that children are being raised with. And my dad said something interesting last week when I proposed this, which was the base values that people are appealing to. So people who leave the faith are appealing to when they want to sort of bring up issues of sexuality, when they want to bring up any other set of cultural issues, they're actually stealing values from Christianity in order to make it happen. They're trying to appeal to some other value within Christianity, which actually Bruce's grace-based videos on Twitter have been dealing with as well, I think, which is saying, there's this other biblical principle you taught me, and what I've learned is that this is the true one, the one. It's love. It's love no matter what. And
wins, bro.
And so love wins. And your other value, you can't see this, but your other value systems, your rules against homosexuality or even against heterosexual like
relationships that aren't marriage, or your cultural dispositions, your political dispositions that seem to be universal across these, quote, conservative Orthodox faiths, they are asserted over love. And really what I've been revealed is that love was the great principle. And so I'm now going to try to, because I think there's a reverse apologetics happening where it goes, I'm now going to try to convince Christians, my other Christian friends and my family, and I'm going to argue with them and stuff, that they are not being consistent to the real value of this religion. And I left because obviously the religion doesn't produce the real value that the great sage Jesus taught. And that's really what this boils down to. So you actually trade a type of moralism for a different type of moralism, I think. And what's interesting is like some people who see this will argue that this is the sort of antinomianism. This is actually the kind of risk that 1517 takes when it wants to focus on the gospel, is that by avoiding the moralism, you're going to make this rule of love win. Mm. And the problem is that's a horrible interpretation of what the gospel is. Like it's a horrible interpretation of what we've taught over the years as well, is that it's just this sort of undefined love that then gets to say the law is bad because love is good, is not the gospel. I don't think it's anything that anybody at 1517 has ever taught, but it is a real thing that's out there. However, it is a moralism. It is a law of love that the people abandon Christianity for, which is very interesting, but is stolen from Christianity.
You know, Augustine points out when he uses the Latin word concupiscence, which is disordered love, that actually all the problem with sin, if you really want to, like, what is sin? People are, well, sin's rebellion, it's doing wrong. And Augustine's like, yeah, but that's not why we sin. We never sin. And Lewis says this in Mere Christianity too, but he's kind of borrowing it from Augustine, which is, well, no one sins for the act of being bad. You sin because you're pursuing some good in a wrong way. And Augustine points out that love is actually the problem as much as it is the solution. Because if you have an ethic that's just like, well, you just have to follow love, Augustine would say, yeah, but love's the reason why you do all the bad things you do. Love's the reason why the serial killer does what he does. Like we have desires and we don't curb those desires, and we can justify any desire as a type of good if we really want to. We have an internal lawyer that will always make that possible. And so, you know, one of the real problems, Augustine points out, is love is actually one of the real problems. And that's why you need a savior, is because you actually are loving the wrong things. And Augustine uses the term in Confessions, he says, my love is my weight. And what he means by that is he's actually using Aristotelian physics then, because that was the way they understood science. And in Aristotelian physics, a thing occupied its space in the world based on the elements that were constituent within it: earth, wind, fire, air. So fire goes up into the sky because it's lighter than earth. Earth stays down on the ground because it's heavier, because it's made of earth. So when he says my love is my weight, what he's saying is that all of us are victims one way or the other to what we love, and that the love pulls us in different directions. So we're passive. We're not actually actively seeking. So like when homosexual people are like, well, I can't help it, I'm homosexual, I love that person, Augustine would say, yeah, your love is your weight. Like, yes, but that doesn't justify anything, because every sin is also that way. Like everything that we do is pulling us. And in English, we maintain that a little bit when we use the phrase fall into love. Like we're not pursuing it, where it kind of comes over us and it trips us up. And I think that when people make love the ultimate ethic, they forget this dangerous side of desire, which the ancient Christian patristic fathers were consistent on, that desire is actually a form of love, but it's disordered. And you just can't make the golden rule, which is a good ethic, which your neighbor friends appear to have, but you can't make it the only ethic, because then it can become tyrannical.
Right. Oh yeah. Mm. Yeah, no, you can see it in, I think, in pretty obvious examples with people as well. I think the challenge for people is like, how do I overcome this? How do I pass this down to my kids when they're going to places where that is the ethic, right? So they're going to a school where the only thing they'll have in common with other people is, I should love these people and I should be nice to them, right? And that somehow sustains the order there. Or sustains the order when you're in line at McDonald's or you're in line at a Disneyland or sporting goods place. Like, what's the base lowest common denominator that I have in common with people? And so that's what you're teaching. But the problem is, I think that gets converted into sort of influence to that being the only thing.
I might be naive in oversimplifying an answer to your question, and you guys have hit.
I want to hear this.
My answer to your question, Caleb, would be the way to pass down values on your kids is actually not to really directly pass down values. Not to say you can't do that, but that the primary thing you should do is give them scriptural intelligence. You know, the ability to know the scripture and understand the scripture. Like, a cheap version of that is what would Jesus do, which is actually a terrible way because there's a lot of things Jesus can do that you shouldn't do. But it's kind of a doorway into the larger principle that I'm saying. Like, if you teach your kids how to think theologically because they are in scripture, they can then receive the traditional values that have been implanted in them through formation and training. And they'll be better equipped to understand why those values have value. But if you just pass on values, well, then they're going to be competing with experience. And that's always a problem. Human experience, cultural, you know, different generations grow up different ways. They value different things. So if you don't ground the value system in a way to think theologically, then it doesn't matter how convincing your argument is on why this value is good. If you grew up in a different generation, have different experiences, you might say, well, this other value is better. So I just think we have scriptural illiteracy at such a high level in Christian circles that that's really a significant reason why we are where we're at.
I'm not sure I disagree with that, but here's the thing. I remember a long time ago, I was in a class, and Rod Rosenblatt was talking about his daughter and a conversation that he was having with a guy named Paul Fairweather, who was sort of like one of Rod's mentors, and he was sort of lamenting that he didn't really know how to raise a daughter and all this kind of stuff. And Paul told Rod, and I've found it to be true in my life, that if you choose to be, you will be the greatest influence in your kids' lives, and nothing they watch on TV, no culture, no set of friends will overtake that. Now, that is maybe oversimplifying things, Bruce. But at the end of the day, I do think and I'm going to try to meld this with Bruce's answer a little bit. I do think that one of the things that happens is that we raise kids and we actually believe that that there is a time, and it's usually a fairly short time, you know, 12, 13, 14, 11, whatever, where we sort of give them over because they're not going to listen to us anymore. You know, we tell ourselves this, you hear it on TV, you'll hear it in even magazines, that you give them over because now they're going to be raised by schools, by teachers, by friends, by sports teams, whatever, you know, coaches and all that, and you give them over. I don't believe that. Like, I don't think that should be the goal. In fact, my current experience is that even with grown children, it's a little harder and the dynamic is much different, but you don't ever stop being, unless you want to, an influence on your kids' lives. You don't ever stop working with them and helping them think things through, cultural things, parenting things, financial things, the whole nine yards. And the question is, how do you get to that point where your kids are willing to still listen to you after whatever magical age that is, 12, 13, 14, 18, whatever. And I don't know for sure. This is starting to sound a lot like an advice show, which we've always tried to avoid. But I do know that Bruce is right in a sense that there's an amazing amount of biblical illiteracy out there. There's also an amazing amount of conversational illiteracy out there. And these two things go hand in hand. So, you know, biblical literacy is one part of it. Theological literacy is another part of it. And how do those two things meld? It's by having an awareness of the scriptures and having had important conversations with the people that matter most to you when you're a child, your parents, about what these things mean and how they, what they meant at the time, what they, and certainly they mean the same thing now. And then how, in a sense, everybody's going to freak out about this, but how is this applicable in any sort of way to my day-to-day life? How do I enact these things? How are they enacted for me? What does the gospel do when I hear it to me? All of these things, if you stay in these conversations as much as you can, and if you sort of do your best to try to avoid, not to avoid the difficult aspects of talking about everything, right? Disregard all of the advice. You absolutely should talk about religion and politics at the dinner table if you want them to know what your thoughts, feelings, and passions are regarding religion and politics. And if somebody's ever had an inspiring teacher or professor, you'll know that you follow the people that actually have deep thoughts and passions on these things. You don't follow somebody who just sort of passively votes one way or thinks one way.
I think the other one would be like starts yelling and screaming about it when it's too late, when their kid has an opposing view.
Talk to your kids about what you think about sex. Talk to your kids about the fact that sex is and can be very enjoyable, but that's in the context of a marriage relationship and all of the pitfalls that even though the physical feelings might be there outside of that marital relationship, how many of the emotional feelings are gone and how much distress that this can cause throughout life, and talk to them about how much it affects the mind and the soul when they share that part of themselves intimately with great numbers of people. Actually have the conversations. Don't be afraid of the conversations. I could go a little more crass on some of that, but at the end of the day,
you could.
Some of this has to do a lot with what Bruce said and a lot with the fact that we treat our children like children and not like people that are smaller than us and live in our houses and that we're supposed to interact with like they're people. You know, other people you wouldn't expect just to follow your lead because you're there, right, for their entire lives. You would expect to have to talk to them, convince them, bring them along with you through the process, study with them, read with them, worship with them, make sure worship isn't just one day of the week, but that involves a decent part of their life. If you want them to continue in that worship, it has to be all encompassing in a way. And that's what makes parenting so hard and so rewarding. You get to not only create, but raise these little people that grow up to be people that hopefully you enjoy spending time with.
Which begs the question about the guy in the screen in the left corner, upper left corner. I won't ask it. I'm just kidding.
I think we enjoy spending time together.
Yeah, I know.
The
last bit, Scott, you're suggesting, you didn't use that term, but just modeling things too.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I don't really have this conversation, but I hear this conversation a lot in church circles, how there's these parents are befuddled when their kids go off to college or whatever, how they just stop going to church and they never come back. And then you think, well, was it a priority in your life, or was it just something kind of a box you clicked, get them to confirmation or whatever? And then especially with kids in confirmation in our tradition, usually it's done at eighth grade, right? Seventh and eighth grade maybe. And then you get communion and then you never see them again. And if church is just a box of check or your Christian life, if you will, quote unquote,
the life
is just a
box.
Right? That's not modeling it at all. And modeling it is on the other side, or the parent side, is very difficult. Especially when you're distracted with financial, things or political, whatever it is, So, I want to push, I'm not pushing back at all. I think when people say you eventually have to trust the other people to start raising your kids, I think as a description of what kind of happens, I think that's true. I mean, I don't think it's a good thing, right? But I think, you know, when, by, you know, whatever age, when your kids start accumulating friends or getting involved in other things, those other influences just do shape them. And so being careful, like what Caleb suggested, you know, with this, you know, the, how you kind of parted ways, is important for parents to do. If you see your kids, I mean, I've kind of learned this, my oldest a little bit is, some days I wish I would have been a little more nosy, you know, and with what he and his friends on the street were up to. But being cool with turning them over to other people and not doing it yourself, that's highly probable. And that's what you were suggesting, Scott.
Yeah.
I think your confirmation example is kind of like where that boils down, Adam, which is like, there is a magical age where maybe it's not other people raising them, but like now it's their decision to do it. So why do you never see those kids at church again? Because they're confirmed. So now we've given them everything the church can give them. It's now their choice if they come or not.
Yeah. That was an aside, and I'm going to have an antinomian minute probably for a second here. I think also the being too hard on people who maybe miss church here or there is...
Yeah, that's not what we're talking about, hopefully.
Yeah. Just to throw that out there. I mean, when kids start working or whatever, and even sports, I wouldn't say that soccer on Sunday should be a priority. Certainly not. But if a kid's involved in something they love and they have to go out of state or whatever for whatever it is, I mean, chill out. All this, the yelling on Facebook, for example, like yelling at people to get to church drives me up a wall. Like, it's just overbearing. And I think my life revolves around church in many ways, right? But when people start doing that, I want to walk away.
Yeah.
I'm like, I totally agree. Reading up my point, Adam, what point I was going to make, which is parenting is really hard because I agree with you and Caleb that you have to, for lack of a better word, sort of police, who your kids are around because they're influential. But then if you get too controlling, you kind of push them away anyway.
Yeah.
So it's a give it.
It's like a real balance, right?
Yeah. It's
a yin and yang.
Right.
I do. No, I got Adam said the right word. This is really, I mean, it's right up my alley talking about this turning into a practical parenting class. I mean, that's right down the middle for me. But, I would say when Caleb was 16 or 17, he probably wished I would have been less nosy and now was happy that I was very nosy.
That's 100% correct.
Yeah. And my nosiness, I don't think, ever turned into maybe once that I can think of. You're not ever talking to that person again, but it mostly turned into a conversation about why are you hanging out with these people? What benefit are they bringing? Are they an influence that's making you better? Or are they an influence that's making you worse? Remember, influences usually are kind of like water. They take the path of least resistance and have these conversations with them. But you can't have the conversation unless you're nosy. Like you can't talk about what you don't know is going on. And so will they push you away, Bruce? Maybe. I think it all depends on how you do it.
And how used they are to those conversations already. So it's like that, if there's like a weird, this sucks, but like if you hit a breaking point and now you have that hard conversation about influence for the first time ever, that kid probably is going to react like in a reactionary way. But like I would say in my life, I was primed by that conversation.
Yeah,
was,
I mean, I don't think you made it past 5 years old before you were asked, why did you choose to be friends with that person?
Yep, exactly. Which, again, I don't think you can guarantee success, but I do think the question that people are asking, and I think, or if they're not asking it, the question people should be asking is why have Christians struggled as a group to pass down values or have their values compete on an equal footing with these new values? And I think a lot of this is correct. I think a lot of the idea of, you know, like things only matter when you're in trouble or the overbearing kind of parent. I think the biblical literacy
Why do we believe what we believe? Because it's in the Bible and God said it, and that makes it amen. You know, kind of answers to children who have questions are unsuccessful. I think, you know, sort of caving and...
even though true, right?
Even though true. Like, that's a totally, you know, it's one of those things. It's like, God said it, I believe it, that's it. True, but not helpful.
The values, though, we haven't really mentioned this, but sometimes the values don't get passed on because the values themselves are under question because of the church, in quotes, bigger church, larger universal church, in a particular time or place, has violated those values or not lived up to those values. I mean, you can think of, for one extreme example, of the sex scandal in the Catholic Church. But you can also take, like, Mars Hill with what's his name? I'm drawing a blank.
Mark Driscoll.
Thank you. Screaming Mark Driscoll. I mean, so, like, there are, the church has also overjudged certain sins to be worse than others consistently. It's conflated politics and religion. It's embraced pedophiles. It's like there's another history here too that's not even on the fault of the parents. It's on the part of the witness of the church as it's lived out its faith hypocritically. And on one hand, you can say, well, the church will always do that because it's made up of sinners. But yeah, that doesn't justify the fact that whenever the church is involved in that kind of public sin, I mean, Paul says this in 1 Corinthians 5, right? Get this guy out of here, because if you don't, even the pagans are going to think we're nuts. So
I agree, but at the same time, since we're talking about parenting, teach your children that this is life too. Like, so what they're going to give up what they believe and were taught at home and in a church to go follow a political movement full of people that are completely 100% in line with the things that they espouse on the campaign trail. I mean, this is life. It is sort of pat to say the church is made up of sinners, but the whole world is made up of sinners. Any sort of movement you attach yourself to that is led by people is going to lead to some sort of disappointment. That doesn't mean, you know, that it's not true or that it's not, that the ideas themselves are not helpful. And certainly in the case of the church, it does not mean that Christ didn't die for your sins, and that the gospel still needs to be heard, because it is the only thing that is efficacious into the power of salvation. And so, you know,
I think that's important in this sense, which is that the church's only mission isn't passing down moral values, right? And so if that is the mission of the church, if the mission of the church is only to create a moral worldview and framework for people to operate in, then those public examples of people failing that, or of the institution failing that for a huge period of time, are devastating to that. However, that is not the central mission. That's a good set of, you know, gifts. Like, this worldview creation and value creation is a good set of what we might call first article gifts, and also the first use of the law that God has given to the church, but it isn't the primary mission for that institution. You know, the proclamation of the gospel is. And so the thing is that you can then lament that those evils have harmed that proclamation of the gospel. And you can lament that with your kids, rather than lamenting or having this weird, you know, nihilism that's like, well, if the institution can't hold up these values, it means I can't. Right. And so I,
yeah, give up. I don't want to say that I don't think that those scandals within the church are horrible. I think they're horrible. And I mean, there's a clear warning that if you should cause a child to stumble, better for you to hang a millstone around your neck and throw yourself into the sea. And those scandals have certainly made have abused many children, have destroyed the lives of many children, and have just the rumors of that abuse have made many people distrust the church and thereby distrust the gospel. And that's a horrible thing that is not reconcilable to the Christian faith and should not be tolerated within the church ever. But I just still think that you can talk with your kids through these things. I'm going to say the last thing. I don't think it's controversial anymore. It's way more popular than when I wrote it now is, but there is a just stark reality that parents are not passing on any values, Christian or otherwise, to this generation. That this is a going out and seeking values where values were not present,
Tolerance is the value that they're passing on.
Yeah, I don't think any moral system is being passed down from generation to generation right now. And I think the reason, one of the primary reasons for that is that there's an absolute lack, not just of present fathers in homes, but active fathers in homes. And there's more and more data on this every day. The data backs me up on this. And I've said this to church after church after church, if you want to have a long-term plan for turning things around, we need to keep men in the church, and we need to encourage men to become fathers, and we need to keep those fathers in the church and active in not just the church, but the home, the driving force of the faith life of the children in the home, and moral life of the children in the home, and probably even epistemological life of the children in the home. Does not mean that the mother does not provide an incredibly amazing task and service in the home and call to the home. She absolutely does. But we live in a culture where the role of fatherhood is absolutely disregarded, and we are reaping what we've sown for that. And it has bled into the church, and we are reaping what we've sown on that. And it's not going to change until that changes, at least, you know, makes a tick in the right direction. So there you go. By being dad, father's picture, it's God's grace.
Yeah. What does the scripture say? You know, and they were wise in their own eyes. That's kind of the ethic of today, right?
Yep.
Like, wise in my own eyes. But of course, that those series of passages that say that, never good. It's never a good thing when they're wise in their own eyes.
And I think one of the things that the fatherhood portion helps with is you kind of have to make it so that, independent of the individual values that you pass down, that the kid or then adult may have questions about or intellectual disagreements about, the consequence to them of like losing or damaging the relationship with their family needs to be so high that they would rather lose friends than lose that, or, you know, lose an opportunity than lose that, or lose social influence than lose that, if that makes sense, right? Like, it just, the relationship with your family, your past, your history, the people and place that have passed down, not just values, but the gospel and all these things to you, needs to be important and be really weighty. I've said before, too, that, like, even the past, you know, like, even when people are considering, like, various, like, Lutheran doctrines or considering things and they're non-Lutheran, If the thing stopping them from, say, converting to my church is strong family bonds and ties and history and respect and honor for the people who have handed down that faith to them, I'm happy and glad for that. I'm happy and glad that, you know, like, a couple of intellectual objections didn't change their whole world overnight because there's something they're anchored and rooted to.
Especially if they're in a church and a belief, you know, system
that is orthodox.
That is orthodox.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, like,
and
orthodox
hold
belief
to some value that rejects, you know, Christ or one of the core tenets of the faith.
And even if they get convinced to personally hold to a different, you know, an alteration on a specific doctrine that's within the broader orthodoxy, you know, there's something really encouraging when somebody, you know, loves or is tied to or rooted to their family and their tradition enough to stand with it, or to want to bring their whole family along with before they do, or something like that, right? And so I just think that's a really key piece, is the relationship with the people who have handed you these things has to be something you value. Has to be one of the values, right? It has to be such an important value that some other things out in the world aren't worth sacrificing that for.
You can ask Adam. I'm usually a downer, but I actually think that we're going to see a bit of a flip on this in the not too distant future. This type of, what did Adam say, solipsism? It's not sustainable. It's just not.
Yep.
It's not internally sustainable for individuals, let alone an entire society, let alone an entire world, right? Since I think Bruce started out with the impact of the internet, and the internet has made regions into countries and countries into the globe, right? And so it's, we'll see a turnaround here. And at the end of the day, you know, we know that whether or not the values that Christianity holds change the entire world forever, we do know that the gospel will do, the preaching of Christ's death and resurrection for your forgiveness will do what is promised to do in scriptures. It will save sinners. It will maintain them in the faith until Christ comes again and brings them home in glory.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, right? The law and the values around the law are command. They don't have a promise to be fulfilled or to change the whole world. The gospel does have a promise attached to it, not just a what if or it might or it may. It has a sure promise. And so I think, yeah, that's keeping that central.
Except for, this is to make Scott's point, except for honor thy father and mother.
Which does, you're right, you will live long.
Your days may be long in the land. So it's the importance of that spiritual formation.
That's why for the first time in 100 years, life expectancy is getting shorter. That's what I think.
Maybe that my lungs are filled with
plastic. Maybe I'm kidding.
That would be sort of like an amazing, you know, like new position to hold. It's like finding the various prophecies and applying them, but doing it with these obscure ones.
Honoring your father and mother, and all of a sudden your body's cleansed of microplastics.
Yeah.
Making a lot of money on it.
So. Well, cool, guys. I think an important conversation. I think one weighing on, I think obviously weighing on a ton of people's hearts and minds. And I agree with my dad. I think it's one that like is very brutal to experience in the moment. But I do have some optimism about the future as well, because I think the collapse of this has made it important to people again and to families again. And I see more and more families sort of like emphasizing the local influence of both dad and mom in the home, talking about faith, talking about the world, before it's too late. And so I
prioritizing getting together with people who think the same thing.
Yeah. And so I've seen it in my own time and place. And so that's encouraging. And I think the more that people ask this question too, I think they'll find some of these answers. So very good. Thank you for joining me this morning. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinking Fellows podcast. Again, if you have enjoyed this show, there's a couple of links down in the show notes below that you would be interested in. The top one would be support this podcast. Thinking Fellows is kept free and ad-free throughout its entire catalog by donors like you. So if you would like to help us maintain this network, help us keep producing episodes, you can hit the support this show link and support us financially. There's also some up-to-date stuff from 1517 down in the show notes. Those change every week. There's new content from us and various advertisements within 1517, not external ones, that you can find down there. And then if you would like to see more from myself and the other hosts, you can go down to the contributors list there, and there are links to our contributor pages. You can see the various things that we've written or recorded for 1517 by following those links. We appreciate your time. We'll catch you next time. Bye.